From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Congress hears another day of public impeachment testimony. This time, Democrats are laying out the case for President Trump's impeachment, trying to show that Trump led a pressure campaign in Ukraine that would benefit President Trump's re-election campaign. Here's House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler framing the arguments against the president.
On July 25th, President Trump called President Zelensky of Ukraine and asked him for a favor. That call was part of a concerted effort by President Trump to compel the government of Ukraine to announce an investigation, not an investigation of corruption writ large, but an investigation of President Trump's political rivals, and only his political rivals.
Republicans, meanwhile, have attacked the substance and the process of the impeachment inquiry. Here's Republican ranking member Doug Collins.
You know, there have been famous moments in impeachment. There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon, like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense?
Joining us now is NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. And Claudia, explain what's happening today in the House Judiciary Committee and why.
Yes, lawmakers are laying down the groundwork for articles of impeachment, and it's more of an extended highlights reel of all the findings from the House Intelligence Committee as they investigated these claims of a pressure campaign led by the president to extract a probe from Ukraine of his political rival. It started with lawyers for the Judiciary Committee presenting their arguments for and against impeachment, and followed by lawyers for the House Intelligence Committee presenting their findings during the formal probe looking into President Trump.
Yeah, a highlights reel is a good way to put it. Democrats today have continued to quote the famous July 25th phone call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky, but they've also dedicated a lot of time to building out the details of a wider pressure campaign around the call. Here's Democratic counsel Daniel Goldman.
It's very important to understand that this investigation revealed that the July 25th call was neither the start nor the end of President Trump's efforts to use the powers of his office for personal political gain. And you have to look at all of the evidence in context as a whole.
As you mentioned, which I just like this point, calling it a highlights reel, what are the major points Democrats have been hitting on?
Yes, they are saying what they uncovered is part of a larger pattern of the president taking risks and abusing the power of his office to accept foreign assistance to interfere in our elections. They're highlighting witness testimony showing they can corroborate the central whistleblower complaint, alerting lawmakers to this July 25th call. And Democrats say the evidence clearly shows the president was pressuring Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 elections on his behalf, and it shows the strongest possible case for impeachment. They're also saying that the president put himself before country. This is something they've repeated several times throughout the hearing, and that he broke his oath of office. And this pattern presents an ongoing risk to the country.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the Republicans. Here's counsel Stephen Castor, one of the common defenses of the GOP he talks about.
President Zelensky has said he felt no pressure on the call. On September 25th at the United Nations, he said, we had, I think, a good phone call. It was normal. Nobody pushed me.
What else are Republicans saying in defense of the president?
They are going line by line trying to attack the possible articles of impeachment. We've received some hints from Democrats what these articles could look like, such as bribery and obstruction tied to this Ukraine investigation. And Republicans are attempting to knock down the evidence related to these potential charges. For example, saying there was no obstruction. They're pointing to witnesses and saying they were providing secondhand information, or they were making assumptions that led to them saying that the president obstructed the investigation from Congress, or that there was bribery involved when he was having these discussions with the leader of Ukraine.
Yeah, the president has also refused to have lawyers in the room. This morning he tweeted, among other things, read the transcripts, witch hunt, and the best economy ever. What does his absence from the hearing room mean for this process?
So this means that lawmakers don't have to consider his defense as a formal part of this inquiry, and that defense can't be included in the record as they develop these potential articles of impeachment. And it also means a part of the process is sped up. If the president had presented a defense, it would extend the time of this inquiry, perhaps add an additional hearing or more, and other evidence that would need to be considered before they reach this decision of potentially drawing up articles of impeachment.
Yeah, the president's not there, but Republicans keep trying to stymie the procedures. We've seen that all throughout the hearings, and they're pushing for their own day of hearings from their own witnesses. Here is one particularly testy exchange between Gerald Nadler and Republicans.
We will now hear presentations of evidence.
I have a parliamentary inquiry.
I haven't removed my objection yet.
I will not recognize a parliamentary inquiry at this time. We
when
will now hear presentations of evidence from counsel to the judiciary.
Is this
chairman.
When we just hear staff ask questions of other staff and the members get dealt out of this whole hearing? And for the next 4 hours, you're going to try to overturn the result of an election with unelected people giving
testimony?
The
gentleman will suspend.
Okay, the last voices we hear are Nadler and Republican Matt Gaetz. Can you explain for us what these procedural arguments have been about?
So Matt Gaetz, among others, they have been arguing that the procedures as they are ongoing with these hearings and this investigation are unfair to the president and not allowing them to present a defense. Matt Gaetz, in particular, is raising the argument that lawyers are there today making all the arguments. They're questioning each other. And he does have a point. Basically, today, the chair and the ranking member have chosen to have their lawyers represent their sides of the cases. So that includes Republicans as well. It's not just Democrats using their lawyers.
Right.
And so that's part of the point that Matt Gaetz and others are leading is they're trying to poke holes in this process in today's hearing, seeing that it is unfair. They're rushing through it and it's not the right structure for them. And they're also asking for this minority day of hearing, which would be a hearing of Republican witnesses. They've made a request for that. And Chairman Nadler has said that it's under consideration, but he hasn't given a final answer. So they're expressing frustration there as well, that their side of the story is not getting told as much as they would like it to be.
Okay, so Nadler has said it's under consideration to have that additional hearing with those witnesses. Can we talk a little bit about the interruptions? Because I'm just thinking about the public at large watching this and trying to make sense of it. They're not totally out of the ordinary, right? Democrats use them during the hearings to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Exactly. Yes, this is a very common strategy that Republicans have used, especially in this process, to try and slow down the hearing, try and muddy the waters, make the Democrats' argument that much less clear, harder to follow. If they're able to accomplish that, they feel that they're accomplishing their goals, which is to throw viewers and listeners off track from paying attention to the hearing and paying attention to these arguments by Democrats that they uncovered this evidence that they say proves that the president abused the power of his office.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Democratic counsel Barry Berke. He's a new figure on this public impeachment stage, and he's a pretty forceful voice. Here he is speaking.
This is a big deal. President Trump did what a president of our nation is not allowed to do. It is why last week the constitutional scholar Professor Michael Gerhardt said, if what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable.
Claudia, what can you tell us about him?
So Barry Berke is with a New York area law firm. He is on leave from that firm at this time, serving as an advisor, a counselor for the Judiciary Committee. So he's nationally known as a trial lawyer and recognized as a top lawyer on white collar criminal issues. And in this case, they have put Barry Berke kind of at the center of this hearing to not only lead some of the arguments, but now he is questioning one of the other attorneys for the Republicans on their arguments. It has proven to bring some very testy moments to today's hearing.
Yeah. I also want to ask you about broadening this out, these impeachment articles. Some Democrats have pushed to keep them narrowly focused on Ukraine, while others want to zoom out and look at the Mueller report, too. Gerald Nadler was connecting the dots between the Ukraine issue and the Russian interference in the 2016 election and the 2020 election. I want to ask you, do you think that Nadler or the other Democrats showed their hand on the articles of impeachment that they might bring against President Trump?
Yes, definitely. We've received hints throughout this process, especially as the House Intelligence Committee was wrapping up its probe. Chairman Adam Schiff hinted that they were looking at bribery as well as obstruction of Congress related to this Ukraine investigation. We've seen Chairman Nadler also hint at these articles of bribery and obstruction of Congress. But as you said, the question facing them now is how broad or narrow to keep these articles of impeachment. If they did broaden them, that would bring in the findings from the Mueller investigation. So that would be an article such as obstruction of justice. But that is a struggle facing Democrats now, whether they want to keep that broad or keep it narrow at this time.
That's NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. Claudia, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Chip Brantley.
And I'm Andrew Beck Grace. We're the hosts of the NPR podcast White Lies, a story about guilt and memory that says as much about America today as it does about the past.
Apple just named White Lies the best true crime show of the year. And if you haven't listened yet, you can binge the entire series now wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
We're following the impeachment hearing on Capitol Hill, the release of the Inspector General's report on the origins of the Russia investigation, and it was a busy weekend in the 2020 presidential race. So who are you going to call? Rick Klein, political director at ABC. Rick, thank you so much for giving us some of your time.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
Well, and take a look with us. Let's start with the impeachment. Today was about lawyers laying out the case for or against impeachment, sifting through the testimony from the hearings, and then taking questions from lawmakers to make their case and craft the articles of impeachment, which will then be voted on. So a big question going in, how much of President Trump's detailed obstruction of justice in the Mueller report on the Russia investigation might be a part of these articles of impeachment having to do with Ukraine? What do you think after watching today?
Well, today was basically a greatest hits, a recap of some of the evidence that's already been presented. And I don't think it furthered the conversation that Democrats are having amongst themselves, which is essentially how broad to make this. They have innumerable items that they might want to include in impeachment articles, but they haven't decided how many to include, whether all of them need to be supported ultimately by all of the Democrats or most of the Democrats or approved on the House floor ultimately. They have some real decisions to make in the coming days. And I think this is kind of wheeling them into action with the testimony that we're hearing today. It's mostly to just remind the American people, remind members of Congress what has been laid out. They still have to make the tough choices.
Well, it is that when the people are actually getting to testify. But there's also been just, a raucous, contentious back and forth on procedure, you know, people yelling at each other. Anybody who was in, their high school government class who, tried to be on any of these committees knows what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to speak out of turn. We heard that over the weekend, the chair, Gerald Nadler, actually rehearsed how to push back against Republican procedural requests. Who's making points here?
Well, the procedural requests are a strategy. And essentially, Republicans are trying to delegitimize the entire process. Say, look, this is a sham. And partly saying that their voice isn't being heard. So they're objecting over and over. They're trying to grind it out, to slow it down. And I'll tell you, in conversation with Democrats, I think it's having some impact on how Democrats are approaching these hearings. They would like this to be a sober discussion, all about the stakes for the American people. These are weighty matters at hand, but they are being sidelined a bit by these procedural arguments and whole kinds of arguments about whether you can go to recess and when, what a point of order properly is, and whether you should be able to grant another hearing and additional witnesses. Those are just distractions, but I'll tell you, they're strategic distractions on the part of Republicans who are basically, rather than playing along on this and having the White House participate with witnesses or even offering an alternate set of facts, they're saying, look, this is not even something that is appropriate to be happening in Congress.
Yeah, but who's going to, again, it is about who wins. This is political. And, the images of these congressmen, yelling and going out of order and overriding Nadler's gavel, might look to their base to be, you know, as you said, just dismissing the process, but they also might look undignified.
That's right, and there's risk in that. Of course, there's also risk in the Democrats pursuing something if they're not moving the American public. And I'll tell you, there's a growing sense among Democrats that the argument has stalled, that yes, you've got more than two-thirds of Americans who think the president did something pretty wrong, but barely half, if half, will say he should be impeached and removed from office. And that really hasn't budged in the polling that we've seen in recent weeks. Yeah. That's problematic for the Democrats, who recognize this has to be bipartisan if it's going to be successful. Right now, they're condemned in their minds to pursuing something that ultimately will fall short, will not gain conviction in the Senate. And in a sense, it just play acts the last couple of weeks when we know how the end of the movie is going to turn out. So I feel like it's a bit of a danger for Democrats to essentially be moving sideways in these hearings, to drift through without knowing that there's an end game that supports their theory of the case.
The Democrats are saying that President Trump put himself before country in asking a foreign country repeatedly to interfere in the U.S. elections, and different countries too. Russia and China have been mentioned. But the ranking Republican, Doug Collins, has come up with a label for this impeachment effort. Let's listen.
There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon, like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here? I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment.
Well, you know, that launched a Twitter frenzy. I'm looking at people who are coming up with lines for this current impeachment inquiry. Lines like, talk to Rudy, everybody was in the loop. I want you to do us a favor, though. I mean, do you think the Republicans are miscalculating in saying there's nothing to see here?
Look, where you stand depends on where you sit in these political arguments. And right now, the Republicans are gaining nourishment and encouragement from their base. And there's not much beyond that. And again, that difference between the 70% of the country that thinks something was done wrong and the 50% that think the president should be impeached and removed, that's significant. That's one in five Americans who need to be convinced that this is actually a removable offense. And the Republican calculation to essentially demonize the whole effort or delegitimize the effort, I think it is having an impact. And I think it leaves the Democrats in a position where they're the ones that have to make the case. The president isn't going to impeach and remove himself. Republicans aren't going to make it easier for them. Ultimately, will voters reward or punish people based on this? Yeah. A lot of things are going to happen over the next 11 months. Impeachment may not be the top 10 list for a lot of voters based on how news cycles work these days, but that is the Republican play right now.
We have to mention also today, the Department of Justice Inspector General report is out on the Russia investigation. Now, this is the independent internal watchdog, and they conclude there was no bias in the launching of the Russia probe, no spying on the Trump campaign, a claim that the Trump campaign had made. They did note serious performance failures, sloppy work by the FBI in looking for a warrant on a former Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page. But, you know, overall, no spying, no bias. But Attorney General Barr is already out disputing the conclusions. If, in fact, he does what he did with the Mueller report, which was dismiss it, does this have any impact?
Well, I think it just further erodes the trust in institutions. It's pretty astonishing to have the Attorney General, who of course heads the FBI, say, actually, I know you're saying that it wasn't that big a deal, but I think it was a big deal, and I disagree with some of these things. And I think, look, there's a kernel in this of, yes, the investigation was properly launched, according to the inspector general. But yes, mistakes were made once the investigation began. That's how you can jump on this. Clearly, this is not the bashing of the Comey Justice Department or the Comey FBI that President Trump has long promised. But there are some missteps in here that have been identified. Mm-hmm. I think it seems to me like the Department of Justice now is trying to undermine any of the potential power of these conclusions. They don't want to get on the wrong side of the president. We've seen what's happened when attorney generals have done that under President Trump in the past.
Yeah. 2020, Joe Biden spoke with NPR's Rachel Martin and denied that he was warned that it looked bad for his son Hunter to be on the board of that Ukrainian energy company. While Biden was vice president and the point person for cleaning up corruption in Ukraine. Here's some of that conversation.
There were former White House aides of yours who tried to warn you about the potential conflicts of interest.
Nobody warned me about a potential conflict of interest. Nobody warned me about that. And at the same time, this
George
was
Kent
done. the State Department official testified that he raised it to you.
No,
and
he
your
didn't
staff,
say
to your
me.
Staff.
He did not
to
say
your staff. I
never,
stand corrected.
Never heard that once.
Look, then there was that run-in that Biden had with the farmer in Iowa. The farmer claimed falsely that Biden sent his son to that company, and Biden responded with, "You're lying." Why can't Joe Biden say, "You know, I'm glad you're mentioning this because it's not true. My son Hunter taking that job was bad optics. It was reported on at the time. But not only did I not protect him, I was trying to get a corrupt prosecutor to investigate more, not less." Why? Go ahead.
It was a powerful interview that Rachel conducted, and I think it was a powerful moment from the vice president. And you see just a raw anger that that comes out of Joe Biden when he's asked about these issues. And maybe given the context of the time, it's all understandable. I've talked to Biden aides who can argue the case either way, that on one level, this is not how you should be acting when you're questioned on issues that are going to come up in the news, the telling off a voter like that, calling him a liar, probably isn't a way to win votes ultimately. The other side says, look, we're in the Trump era. And you want someone who's going to get tough, and you want something that's going to get real. And he alluded to this in the interview with Rachel. You want to be genuine in your interactions with voters and with reporters. And on that level, maybe it's a good thing that Joe Biden is flashing some anger.
Yeah. Pete Buttigieg, I think, didn't have a very good weekend. I mean, I'd love your read on it. He sparred with Elizabeth Warren over the transparency of their fundraising. And then there's his work at McKinsey. This is the huge company that consults for corporations and governments. And in ways many Democratic voters might find disturbing, like, for instance, advising the U.S. to cut food for migrants on the border. And in an event last week, the Chicago mayor, Lori Lightfoot, urged Buttigieg to claim the moral high ground and break a non-disclosure agreement that he says is keeping him from talking about his work at McKinsey. Let's listen.
I am asking my former employer to do the right thing, to not make me choose between claiming the moral high ground and going back on my word.
Yeah, but
they could
going
fix
to,
this
right?
tonight.
And NDAs are courts across the land have said that they're not enforceable. You should break the NDA.
I'm going to give him a chance to do the right thing, and then we'll take it from there.
Look, McKenzie was, I think, Buttigieg's only job before winning, you know, mayor of South Bend with maybe something like 8,000 votes. Is this underscoring a little of his greenness?
Well, I think it's a tough storyline for him. Yes, he was a pretty junior person at McKinsey, and some of the things that are more controversial have happened long since his tenure. He wasn't a decision-making place at the time. But look, he's got a target on his back now, and people like Elizabeth Warren are going to scrutinize his fundraising practices and his past, and he's going to have to be vetted in a way that he's never had before. That's what you get when you're a frontrunner.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC, taking a few minutes to go through everything that's going on. Rick, we always appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
While big retailers like Forever 21 and Barney's are filing for bankruptcy, Dollar General is doing exceptionally well. The bargain brand for everything from snacks to laundry detergent has seen its same-store sales grow for the last 28 years, and next year it's opening 1,000 new locations. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News. And Jill, this is a company that has seen its stock go up by 50% over the last 2 years. Why is Dollar General doing so well right now?
I think you hit it with the rock bottom prices. And I think the company has really remained true to that mission. And they focus on what they call their core customers. And those are folks who make around $40,000 a year. The company also notes that that group has seen wages rise only modestly over the last decade or so. And I think along the way, the chain has reached some higher income shoppers who like the discounts, but that's not their core customer that they're going for.
Yeah, Dollar Store says their customers have stayed loyal and have not uptraded for big box stores like Walmart. Tell us about their strategy specifically.
Yeah, I think the company took advantage of a couple of trends, especially in the last 5 years or so. So think about it. So many brick and mortar retailers have pulled up stakes, and that led to an opening, right? So you had a lot of folks who were saying, well, I used to go to this place or that place. It's no longer there. Additionally, yeah. Walmart has stopped opening a lot of their new superstores. And finally, Dollar General had a rival called Dollar Tree, still a rival. And Dollar Tree actually bought this company called Family Dollar back in 2015. Their rival was targeting the suburban middle-income shoppers. And you know what? Dollar General said, no, thank you. We're going to do what we know best. We're going to focus on the lower income and rural customers.
What I found really interesting, though, is that some cities are not really happy about Dollar General's expansion. Tulsa, Oklahoma, for example, Birmingham, Alabama, they've even banned Dollar General from opening new locations. What is the issue they have?
Well, the critics claim that stores like the Dollar General are actually intentionally clustering their stores in low-income areas, and that would essentially discourage other markets from opening and also at the same time threatening existing mom-and-pop grocers. So opponents also say that these dollar stores, they don't have fresh produce, and that's a bad thing. And I think that from Dollar General's point of view, they're saying, no, 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 it's the exact opposite. We're filling the void as these other places leave town, and we are the ones who are helping to serve underserved populations.
Interesting. With the little bit of time that I have with you, let's talk a little bit about tariffs. Analysts were predicting that tariffs would hit the dollar store industry really hard, but so far that hasn't seemed to happen. Why not?
Well, you know, if you look at the rounds of tariffs that are already in place, they've mainly hit industrial goods, also America's farmers, not consumer-based ones. But, you know, we have a new deadline approaching December 15th that would actually hit consumer goods, a 15% tariff on $156 billion of Chinese imports. If that doesn't get pushed back, that's where we might see some impact trickle down to us consumers, regardless of where you shop.
Yeah, just in time for the holidays, too. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, the House Judiciary Committee is hearing evidence from Democratic and Republican lawyers on President Trump's dealings with Ukraine, making the case for and against impeachment. Testimony today may influence the articles of impeachment being drafted by House Democrats and whether they'll broaden their scope beyond Ukraine to include obstruction of justice charges tied to the president's attempts to interfere with the Mueller investigation. The beginning of the hearing was interrupted by a protester yelling that the Democrats were committing treason. Then in his opening statement, Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler said President Trump put his own interests before the country's.
As we proceed today, we will hear a great deal about the speed with which the House is addressing the president's actions. To the members of the committee, to the members of the House, and to my fellow citizens, I want to be absolutely clear. The integrity of our next election is at stake. Nothing could be more urgent. The president welcomed foreign interference in our elections in 2016. He demanded it for 2020. Then he got caught. If you do not believe that he will do it again, let me remind you that the president's personal lawyer spent last week back in Ukraine meeting with government officials in an apparent attempt to gin up the same so-called favors that brought us here today and forced Congress to consider the impeachment of a sitting president. This pattern of conduct represents a continuing risk to the country. The evidence shows that Donald J. Trump, the president of the United States, has put himself before his country. He has violated his most basic responsibilities to the people. He has broken his oath. I will honor mine. If you would honor yours, then I would urge you to do your duty. Let us review the record here in full view of the American people, and then let us move swiftly to defend our country.
The Republican case today is focused on the way the Democrats have been handling the impeachment process, as Nadler said. They say it's an excuse to get rid of a Republican president they don't like. In his opening statement, the ranking Republican, Doug Collins, referred to this as the Democrats' focus group impeachment.
There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon, like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here? I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment. Because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do, except that interfere and basically make sure that they believe the president can't win next year if he's impeached. The focus group impeachment takes words and then takes them to people and say, how can we explain this better? Because we don't have the facts to match it. A focus group impeachment says, you know, we really aren't working with good facts, but we need a good PR move. That's why we're here today. This is all about, as I said last week, a clock and a calendar. And it really became evident to me that this was true because last Wednesday, after we had a long day of hearing here, the next morning, before anything else could get started, the Speaker of the House walked up to the podium and said, go write articles of impeachment. She just quit. She just stopped. Go write articles of impeachment. I appreciate that the majority practiced for 2 days this weekend on this hearing. I appreciate that the fact that you got to try and get it right to try and convince the American people of your problem, but your speaker's already undercut you. She took the thrill out of the room. You're writing articles of impeachment. Why couldn't we just save that time today, and if you're going to write the articles of impeachment, go ahead and write them? Well, there's probably a reason for that, because the chairman laid out some amazing claims, none of which I think after this hearing today, the American people can honestly look at and see that there is overwhelming evidence, there is a proper reason he abused this power, because as the speaker, another statement she said, that to do impeachment you have to be so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, all of which we are not.
By the way, with that speech, Collins launched a Twitter storm of suggestions for memorable impeachment lines, including, yes, there was obstruction of justice, and do me a favor, though. Also today, Republicans delayed proceedings with points of order several times throughout the hearing.
Show me, please, in the rule. Have your parliamentarian show me in the rules where you come to a time of actually being able to deny this up at a certain point.
Further reserving the right to object.
As I have said...
Further reserving the right to object.
The point of order would be in order at the meeting where we are considering articles.
Further reserving the right to object.
We will now hear presentations.
Mr. Chairman, I appeal the decision of the chair.
There's no decision to appeal. There was not a ruling and a motion. We will now hear presentations.
There's a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order, Mr. Chairman. You can't then not allow us to appeal the ruling of the chair.
The gentleman will suspend. It was not a cognizable point of order. It was not a cognizable point of order. It was not in order at this time to make that point of order. There is no ruling to appeal.
But Mr. Chairman, it's now, the rule was for the obligation, not consideration. You are obligated to schedule, not to consider. Made a ruling. It is in order to appeal.
The gentleman will suspend. We are doing what we have to do under the rules. We will now hear presentations of evidence.
Mr. Chairman,
the gentleman is not recognized. We will now hear presentations of evidence.
I have a parliamentary inquiry.
I haven't removed my objection yet.
I will not recognize a parliamentary inquiry at this time. We will now hear presentations of evidence from counsel to the judiciary.
Is this when we just hear staff ask questions of other staff and the members get dealt out of this whole hearing? And for the next 4 hours, you're going to try to overturn the result of an election with unelected people giving testimony?
Gentlemen will suspend.
That last voice, the Republican Matt Gaetz, objecting to Chairman Nadler's refusal so far to grant Republicans' request for a minority hearing day. The Republican Stephen Castor, Republican lawyer for the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, made the case today that there's not enough evidence that the president committed any impeachable offense. Here he is referring to Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian President Zelensky, which alarmed the whistleblower and set off this impeachment inquiry.
The purpose of this hearing, as we understand it, is to discuss whether President Donald J. Trump's conduct fits the definition of a high crime and misdemeanor. It does not. Such that the committee should consider articles of impeachment to remove the president from office, and it should not. This case, in many respects, comes down to 8 lines in a call transcript. Let me say clearly and unequivocally that the answer to that question is no. The record in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry does not show that President Trump abused the power of his office or obstructed Congress. To impeach a president who 63 million people voted for over 8 lines in a call transcript is baloney.
But here is Daniel Goldman, chief House Intelligence Committee investigator, laying out evidence that President Trump did abuse his power.
The extensive evidence that the committee's uncovered during this investigation led to the following critical findings. First, President Trump used the power of his office to pressure and induce the newly elected president of Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 presidential election for President Trump's personal and political benefit. Second, in order to increase the pressure on Ukraine to announce the politically motivated investigations that President Trump wanted, President Trump withheld a coveted Oval Office meeting and $391 of essential military assistance from Ukraine. Third, President Trump's conduct sought to undermine our free and fair elections and poses an imminent threat to our national security. And fourth, faced with the revelation of his pressure campaign against Ukraine, President Trump directed an unprecedented effort to obstruct Congress's impeachment inquiry into his conduct. And with that context in mind, I would like to turn to the evidence of President Trump's conduct concerning Ukraine. My colleague, Mr. Castor, just said that it revolves around 8 lines in one call record. But that sorely ignores the vast amount of evidence that we collected of a months-long scheme directed by the president.
Just some highlights from today's House Judiciary Committee hearing on impeachment. We'll, of course, continue to cover this for you here and now.
As expected, the World Anti-Doping Agency has banned Russia from all major sporting events, including the next 2 Olympics. WADA's executive body made the decision today in Switzerland, affirming a recommendation by one of the organization's committees last month. The agency's president said Russia has chosen deception and denial as opposed to compliance with the regulations. The BBC's Alex Kapsick joins us now from the meeting in Switzerland. And Alex, remind us first, what's the basis for this 4-year ban and what did Russia do exactly?
Well, this all goes back to the huge doping scandal in Russia between 2011 and 2015. It affected results in the 2012 Olympics in London and then the 2014 Sochi Winter Games, which Russia hosted. And in Richard McLaren's report in 2016, he described it as a state-run systematic doping conspiracy across many, many different sports. And what happened after that is that the World Anti-Doping Agency made Russia non-compliant with its code. And that ban was in place until September the 2018, when they controversially lifted it. But part of the conditions for lifting that ban was that they must hand over drug testing data related to drug tests taken in that period up until 2015. WADA felt that there were around about 145, 150 athletes who had benefited from the doping conspiracy, hadn't yet been caught and hadn't yet been punished for that. But when they were finally given the information, that was in January this year, they then analysed it forensically and found that, once again, the Russians were trying to cover up positive drug tests. And that's why they came to the decision today that that they should implement what has been described by some as a harsh punishment, a 4-year ban from all global international sporting events.
Okay, so just lay out for us what this means exactly. Does it mean that they won't be able to participate in the Olympics in Tokyo?
Yes, what it means is that they will not be allowed to compete under the Russian flag. So the Russian flag, the Russian anthem, all banned from any major international tournaments. That includes the Olympic Games. It includes the World Cup in Qatar, the FIFA Football World Cup in Qatar in 2022. They have said, though, that individual athletes will be allowed to compete as long as they can prove they weren't involved, they're untainted by this doping conspiracy, but they will have to do so under a neutral banner. Quite what they're called, that's still to be determined.
I'm curious, how common is that for athletes to compete individually without the banner of having a country?
It's happened before. It happened at the 18 Pyeongchang Winter Games. Russia was banned then for the previous doping scandal, and 168 Russian athletes competed. There they were called the Olympic athletes of Russia. It's happened also with other countries. Other countries have been banned, and individual athletes have still been allowed to compete under a neutral banner. The question this time, I think, is what the Russian athletes will be called, because this is a second offence. They've been found to have been trying to cover up positive tests. Again, these are aggravated circumstances, so I don't think the authorities will want to have the name Russia anywhere near.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this has been an ongoing issue in Russia. Have they done anything to try to address what's going on?
Well, if you listen to the man who heads up the anti-doping program now, a man called Yuri Ganas, he says they have. And in fact, WADA is very happy with the anti-doping operation in Russia. They put the blame for this on the Russian authorities, you know, right up towards the top of the Russian government. I mean, Vladimir Putin is not named, but certainly officials high up in his administration, they think that they might have something to do with this. They're not blaming the individual athletes. They're not blaming the anti-doping program. What they say is that the authorities need to come clean with what has happened. And if they can move on then, but they have to put this ban in place, they have to put this punishment in place because, you know, enough is enough, frankly. They've been caught once and they've been caught again. And for some people, this suspension is not enough. Lots of people are saying, because Russia are repeat offenders, that should have been a blanket ban, so all athletes should have been banned as well. There should be no one from Russia allowed to compete at these major tournaments.
Russia can appeal, right? They can appeal this decision.
Yeah, that's the next stage in this, Tanya. Russia now has 21 days in which they can lodge an appeal, and if they do, it will go to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and they will have the final say. Quite when that will happen, we don't know. I mean, let's just accept that Russia is going to appeal, because that's what people think is going to happen. They could then drag it out, and this could take months. It could take to beyond the Tokyo Olympics, and during that time, Russia will be allowed to compete. If in the end, the Court of Arbitration for Sport uphold the decision to punish Russia in this way, it will be down to the individual federations to implement that. So that's the International Olympic Committee or FIFA, which runs the Football World Cup. It still could get a bit messy.
Lots to follow here. That's BBC's Alex Capstick speaking with us from Switzerland. Alex, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.